If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Zyn is America's number one nicotine pouch. It's made with only 6 simple ingredients. Plus, Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day hassle-free trial. There are lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
When I've done work in Los Angeles and New York, and I've never lived in either of those cities, but I spent a good amount of time in them getting to work. When people found out that I was based in Chicago, they were always kind of gobsmacked. It was like, well, why did they fly your dumbass in here when there's, you know, 50 million? There's so many talented actors here. And you're, I don't get it. You know? So there was always like a certain amount of, you know, low-key glee that I had kind of beat the odds just by getting a seat at the table from Chicago.
Yeah.
But I also felt like a representative of what the city has to offer. Chicago is lousy with incredibly talented actors. Hi, my name is John Hoganacker, and I'm just a guy doing acting stuff.
Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to welcome you all to this week's episode of Off the Beat. I am your host, as always, Brian Baumgartner. And I'm also very excited to announce that the incredible John Hoganacker is joining us today. Just like me, John has an extensive theater background, working on productions like Antony and Cleopatra, Hamlet, and one of my dark, dark favorites, Killer Joe. He, of course, didn't stop at theater. Since those good old days, he has taken the film and television world by storm, jumping into some very intense and very impressive roles on shows like Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, Dope Sick, and Waco, The Aftermath. Now, he is here to go deep into his life and his career, from his commercial days, Dilly Dilly, anyone, to working on Jack Ryan with some guy named John Krasinski. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. I definitely haven't. All jokes aside, this is a great conversation. So without further ado, John Hoganacker, everybody.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
What's up, John?
Hey, man, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm sorry. I'm not wearing the headphones. We tried to figure the whole thing out, and of course, it all fell apart. The wheels came off the trolley at the last minute, so here we are.
Listen, I know exactly what that's like every day of my life. It's so nice to talk to you. I really am such a big fan of yours and what you have been doing here.
I'm a fan of yours, man. It's cool to be hanging out.
Yeah, we have a lot of things in common. Some are mostly manufactured by me, but we do have a lot in common. You grew up, I understand, in the South, right? In Charlotte?
I sure did. In fact, I'm actually in the South now.
Oh, you're in the South right now. You live in the South?
Yes, I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina, and yeah. A lot of family in the mountains. So I was coming up here a lot as a kid, and we moved back to the Asheville area during the pandemic.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you love it?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I love it so much. I had a lot of stuff that I needed to kind of take care of, needed to be closer to family, and a lot of, I don't know if this is the way your experience of this job being an actor is, but a lot of stuff for me comes down to taping anyway. When I was in Chicago, a lot of the jobs that I was winning or that were filming around the country were from tapes. And, you know, when we got deep into the belly of the pandemic, my wife and I were kind of like, let me back up. I went to do Dope Sick, which filmed in Richmond. And my wife and the kids came out for the month of March. And we spent the whole, and, you know, in the South, it's like the flowers are on the trees in March. It's like spring. Right. The birds are singing. And then we finished and she went back home. And the same 2 feet of snow was on the ground that was there when she left in Chicago. And it was, you know, going to be winter for another couple months. And
right.
She was bummed about it. And I was like, well, what if we just went ahead and did it, made the move. So it has, it's been wonderful, wonderful change of pace. It's a gentler rhythm. I feel like when I travel, I live in a yoga studio and I take that yoga studio with me. People in New York are like, dude, you're so chill.
It is a beautiful area. There's a little town called Greenville, South Carolina, which is not overly far from you, which I had relatives that lived in Green. I was in Atlanta and I had relatives that lived in Greenville. When I was a kid, Greenville was nothing. I'm just going to say it straight out. And now it is a booming mid-size, mid-city metropolis with great food and places to go and river walks, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
What Greenville has that Asheville does not have is a Costco. I mean, it's the little things.
So right.
We want, you know, I want 36 rolls of toilet paper. I'm going to Greenville.
That's right. Well, and to finish this off, yet another weird connection. I am flying tomorrow. This is not a joke. This was not planned. I am flying tomorrow morning to Chicago. I had several weeks ago been in Wyoming and I was like, whew, we're done with the winter. I packed up all my winter coats. I packed up. I'm like, I'm done with the winter. I'm flying. We're in late April here. We're definitively in late April and I'm flying to Chicago tomorrow. The high is going to be 40 on Saturday and Sunday. I can't even believe that this is happening. I mean, I'm going to have a great time. Don't get me wrong, but yes, I am. I can't believe it.
You're getting on that plane under your own steam, Brian. So you did it to yourself. And it's, you know, the thing, one of the things that I'm proud of myself for is that every time the weather's beautiful here in Asheville, I don't take like a screenshot of the weather app and send it to my friends in Chicago, but I fight. That's a daily battle that I'm always fighting.
Right. Yes.
You know, the dogwood trees are blooming right now.
Beautiful.
In a month or so, it's going to be like rhododendrons and mountain laurels. And it's just a lovely part of the world.
Do you golf?
Oh, yeah. You know what? I've been a golfer my entire life, but you would not know it by watching.
There are great courses. I play a lot of golf. It's funny. When I get homesick for the South is the Masters, being from Georgia. And it's because of what you're talking about. It's the azaleas. They got it timed perfectly, man. The beginning of April, the azaleas come out, the dogwoods. And I'm like, oh, man, yeah, that is really beautiful. enough about weather. Well, so another thing you and I have in common, you did the forensics thing.
Oh, yeah.
State and district champion of I was state champion there 2, 3, 4 years or something there in Georgia. Is that where you started performing, or did you have an interest in it and that's what brought you to that?
Well, you know, I did. So my dad did commercials in Charlotte. He was a life insurance salesman, and he did you know, voiceover and television commercials. And he was a real like funny guy. He was the life of the party. And, you know, so I looked up to him and I wanted to emulate him. So I got in trouble all the time in school. I was a class clown. And when I was in like fifth and sixth grade, I started doing plays at the Children's Theater in Charlotte. And then I got braces and I had braces for a few years. And my dad was like, well, there's no market for a child with braces, John. By around early high school, I think I got into debate around like probably sophomore year, because at that point we still had junior high, you know, which was right. 6 through 9. And then you had 10 through 12 for high school. And my debate coach, I don't know, did you compete in like humorous and terp and dramatic and terp?
Yes,
and
that kind of humorous and dramatic. That's right. Yes.
Well, cool. Yeah. And for the listeners who don't know what Brian and I are talking about, it was like you would basically pick a play, or it could be a TV show, or it could be a movie. You would do a 10-minute cutting, and you had to have an introduction somewhere in there. You had to basically keep your feet planted, but you could play all the characters. And I went after Monty Python because I was like, surely everybody wants to hear my rendition of a Holy Grail. And I debate, it's like Monty Python never wins, but knock yourself out. And Monty Python did not win for me. Right. Then I started doing different plays and had a lot of fun with it. And yeah, I got to be, I was a state champion 2 times and I was a district champion 2 times. So that was a lot of fun, but that kind of strengthened the audition muscle probably more than anything else, because then, you know, when I was towards the end of high school, kind of on a lark, I auditioned for the theater school at DePaul University. And, you know, I didn't even go for Juilliard because it seemed unattainable. It was more expensive, the audition process. And Chicago seemed, I don't know, it seemed tamer at the time than New York City.
Right.
I got in, which was very cool. The school was a super intense program. Did you do a theater conservatory or anything like that for college?
I did. I went to SMU in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Solid school. Yeah. So the program for us, I don't know, did you guys have a cut program too at SMU?
You know, there were no cuts, but people cut themselves. I mean, I think we started out with 15 actors and, you know, by the end, you know, 7 or 8 would make it 4 years. Yeah.
It was the same. Not a lot. It was basically the same, same percentage that we lost. They brought in 70 some our first year in 95. Then they cut half of us after the first year. Wow. They cut half of the remaining after the second year. And then if you made it past the second cut, you were in the casting pool for your junior and senior year. Yeah. And so that the NFL thing, the debate, the forensics thing, always helped me when it came time to get in front of a team of producers and a director or something, kind of walk in and try and own the room, because I had been doing that in front of fellow teenagers for, you know, 3 or 4 years, getting the stink eye from competitors.
You know, that's interesting. I have never, truly, I have never made that connection before, but of course you're right. Because that experience with, you know, 3 judges and a few other people watching, which does, you're exactly right. It does mimic that the audition experience later on. There's 3 or 4 judges. Yeah, that's very interesting, John. I'd never really thought about that before, but the advantage for having just done it, whether you've done it well or not, just getting comfortable walking into a small setting, it's much easier to perform, I think, in front of 1,000 or 2,000 people sometimes than those really small rooms, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You've probably done the black box theater thing too in your life.
Yes.
Had a lot of opportunities to do that in Chicago. A lot of great spaces. There's nothing like that live experience. And as we move into the AI age, I think the craziness is it'll be theater actors at the end of the day who are the only ones.
Right.
But yeah, the ability to kind of go into a room of people and you're all live beings sharing space, and you kind of start to cast a spell that whips everybody up. It's a really, really amazing thing to get to be a part of.
So when you go to DePaul, have you decided in your mind that this is what you want to do, that you want to be an actor?
I just was positive that I was going to go to Second City and do the whole thing. In high school, especially because of the HI thing, humorous and terp, the debate thing, I thought I was going to do stand up. And I had a first year acting teacher that I absolutely revered, kind of pulled me aside one day. And he was like, you know, John, you remind me of Robin Williams. And that was like, nobody could have said a kinder thing to me. And then he dropped the other, which was that to him, that was not a compliment. And it crushed me. And the school was very, very hard for me in that regard. It was like, you know, they always talk about when you join the Marine Corps, boot camp is about stripping away the individual and turning you into this one thing that doesn't really think. You just complete the mission. You're part of a team. And in a very odd way, that was what going to college to be an actor was for me. You know, I remember going for the audition and being surrounded by all these kids in leotards doing like vocal warm-ups and being like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I had no idea. I had no idea. That was why, right. I was sure. I was like, well, I'm not getting in here. So I feel like a lot of my career has been about trying to tap back into some of that fairy dust, you know, that I had in my soul before I came to a theater conservatory.
Right.
I don't know if that even answered your question remotely, but
I don't know either, but two, that's very, very interesting because I think that, you know, I mean, I am tremendously grateful for the experience that I had and the training that I have. But I think that you bring up an interesting point, which, by the way, at least at SMU, the teachers talked about, which is you're learning all of these tools and movement and voice and action and objective and all of those things. And then eventually you are supposed to just let it go and go back and have it be a part of your training, but not what you're focusing on. And I think especially young actors get wrapped up in that process and sort of falling in love with the process, which then, you know, doesn't enable you to perform.
Yeah, totally.
You mentioned something, you talked about boot camp, and I do want to touch on this because this is, well, unique. And by the way, this is not a place we connect. You spent a bit of time at the Naval Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps. Now, one, what is this? And how old were you? Was this a potential path for you early on?
Man, that was a deep dive, bro. I'm so glad you asked that question. That's really, really cool. Yes, it was a potential path for me at one point. My dad, as I mentioned, was selling life insurance. When I was in seventh grade, the group of people that my dad was selling life insurance with dissolved. And to me, as a kid, I thought, oh no, my dad's out of work. I have to secure my own future. And that was, you know, in a way that was kind of true for a little while. But at Carmel Junior High, where I grew up in Charlotte, in your ninth grade year, you could begin NJROTC. In high school, they have JROTC. And it can be, you know, typically it's Air Force, Army, or Navy. So I believe maybe there are some Marine Corps schools. But in the eighth grade year, the master sergeant who was in charge of our ninth grade year would bring in a small group of eighth graders that he would kind of train alongside the ninth graders. And then they would become the, for lack of a better term, the cadet commanders of that ninth grade year when they became ninth graders. So that was me. I went up to Master Sergeant Paget. This guy wore a smoky and had gotten into the Marine Corps at age 17 from a very poor background in Tennessee and parental consent, and got to go to Korea as essentially a child. Came back and became a drill instructor at Parris Island, and then became the head of the drill instructor training school at Parris Island. So this guy was like Lee Ermey from Full Metal Jacket. I mean, he was but the real thing.
Right.
And he was, despite being a super intense character, I learned so much about how to comport yourself in society, how to be a responsible grown-up, how to wear a suit, and about decorum. So I started to discern a path to college for myself. Mm-hmm. But I was also beginning to see the cliques in high school, and I was seeing the ROTC clique and seeing myself as being a part of that clique. And I was beginning to think of it in terms of, you know, this is in retrospect, Brian, but it was really a role that I was playing.
Right.
And I was not ultimately cut out for that. I did not want that to be my life. I think I was wise enough at that age, not that I was super wise, but I was wise enough to know that I wasn't ready to commit to that for the rest of my life. And I wanted to experience more. So halfway through ninth grade, I backed out and got a pair of Birkenstocks, and here I am.
You joined the clique across the cafeteria, like that was on the other corner of the cafeteria.
I mean to tell you, man, within like a year and a half, my hair was down to here and it was like hacky sack every morning. But again, it was like, I'm very glad that I had that experience. It's good to kind of feel like you're being a part of something civic minded, especially if it's not to the detriment or to the exclusion of any one group. That's the main thing.
Yeah. I don't have that specific experience, but I think that what you're talking about is so valuable, that you have a variety of experiences, go through a variety of different groups, if you will. Or, I mean, and it sounds like you being civic minded and choosing something that was civic minded, that's, well, A plus to you. But just having that experience to pull from as an actor later on is invaluable. And it never makes sense to me when you find that click, or you decide, oh, I'm, you know, a theater kid or whatever, too early on, and you turn your nose up to other experiences or whatever, I think you're doing yourself a disservice for the thing that you ultimately want to do.
100%, Brian. And I think that's what you're saying is really about, you need to kind of experience as many different walks of life as you can,
right,
on your way to being a well-rounded person. And that's what really childhood, ideally, and adolescence and young adulthood are all about.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Not only did Zyn create the first ever nicotine pouch, we're still America's number one choice for smoke-free, spit-free nicotine satisfaction. It could be because Zyn is made with only 6 simple ingredients, including naturally derived nicotine salt. Or maybe it's because Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day trial. For anyone worried Zyn won't cut it like traditional tobacco, just ask one of the millions of people who have achieved lasting change. You have lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at Zyn.com/find. That's Zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You mentioned before you thought Second City was your path. That's what you were going to do. Doing a little dive into your resume, it sounds like that's not exactly what happened as you left DePaul. Anthony and Cleopatra, Hamlet, The Iceman Cometh, Tracy Letts, Killer Joe, by the way, which nobody is going to know. Oh, they did make a movie of it. That play blew my mind. So you become fairly quickly a working actor in one of the theater hotbeds in the country, Chicago. Talk to me a little bit about your experience. And did you then think that that was your life?
I've always dreamed of having a path kind of like what I envision the English actor's path to be. They get to have this great theater background, and then they sort of at some point in their careers, they graduate into getting to also concurrently do film and television. And that's on the bucket list, too. I want to be a detective in Western North Carolina.
Okay. All right. You've come close, by the way. We'll talk about that. You've come pretty close, but all right. Go ahead.
No. So yeah, that was like the Anthony and Cleopatra was an audition that I did when I was still in college. And I got to play the role of Scarus, which is a guard, like not a big role at all. But I got to be on stage with Larry Yando, Kevin Goodall, Lisa Dodson, Bradley Armacost, Scott Parkinson, and Barbara Gaines was directing. These are like luminaries of Chicago classical theater and theater in general in Chicago. And it was like, holy shit. Anything can go wrong on this stage in real time while we're doing Shakespeare, and one of these geniuses is just going to fix it. Like, we can just pull and we can ride this, and we're all together, and we're going to support each other, and we'll get to the end. And the crowd, even especially if they see the fuck ups, they're going to love it. They'll go banana. And I had spent 4 years learning all of this stuff in an institutional environment, but it wasn't until I got on stage with these pros that it was like my education truly began in earnest. So that was going on. And then I did that first production. And then in the February of 2000, first year out of college, the production that Mike Shannon had taken to New York with Tracy Letts play Killer Joe, came back as a profit production. And the rules were at that point that they had to hire two kids in their 20s under union contract. So I had to join the union at 23 years old in Chicago, in a city at the time which was lousy with dudes my age who were non-equity, well into their 30s.
Right.
So it was like, who the hell do you think you are, man? Like, you graduated college 15 minutes ago, and now I got to pay for healthcare bucket? I don't think so. But, I was like, when I got that job, it was like the grittiest theater going on in Chicago, despite the fact that it was a production coming back from out of town. And after that, I mean, it was so intense, Brian, that like my wife would pick me up after shows sometimes, and she wouldn't know who was getting in the car with her. But I was making a living as a theater actor in Chicago, and I was getting money into my healthcare. So I knew that the next year I'd be able to go to the doctor and do these kinds of things. And I felt like, even though it seemed like a gamble because there were so many incredibly talented actors my age, it was worth it because I knew that this was what I wanted to do. And then I survived as a union actor by winning jobs that took me to other places out of Chicago until I was old enough to kind of be in the casting pool in Chicago as a union actor.
Are you, at this point, are you thinking about film and television? Where do you see your life heading at that point?
I guess I had some dim idea that I would be one of the few people who booked a series regular role in the show that came to Chicago, okay. Which, as you know, that was very rare. Typically, when a big production is coming to a place like Minneapolis or to Chicago, it's because they're shooting on location in those cities, and there is a pretty strong well of talent local there to pick up the smaller roles. So a lot of the bigger, better roles are already cast before those shows come to Chicago.
That's right.
And I began to figure that out probably early on, but I got to my first like on camera job was with Clint Eastwood directing, and it was Flags of Our Fathers. And George Grizzard was in the scene that I got to do. It was a really heady experience. And they gave me half of a trailer. And that was my first job. That was my first job. So I thought that was what being an actor was going to be. I was getting on camera work often enough to where I thought, yeah, this is building to something. I was also really interested in doing voice work. So from a very early age, I was chasing voiceover. So I got to do a lot of voiceover over the years too, which helped me kind of make ends meet and kind of string it together. But I always thought there's going to be a role that's going to take me to Los Angeles, or there's going to be a role that's going to take me to New York. I'm not going to leave work that I'm actively doing in this vibrant community to search it out.
Interesting. Did you find that able to be true?
I will say that when I've done work in Los Angeles and New York, and I've never lived in either of those cities, but I spent a good amount of time in them getting to work. When people found out that I was based in Chicago, they were always kind of gobsmacked. It was like, well, why did they fly your dumb ass in here when there's 50 million? There's so many talented actors here. And I don't get it. You know? So there was always like a certain amount of, you know, low-key glee that I had kind of beat the odds just by getting a seat at the table from Chicago.
Yeah.
But I also felt like a representative of what the city has to offer. Chicago is lousy with incredibly talented actors. like middle America, just solid, natural acting. And I feel so grateful for the time that I got to spend there continuing to study and continuing to grind. Like it was a grind. Particularly when you're dealing with Mother Nature, which, you know, is, you know, pleasant in Chicago for like maybe 3 months of the year combined.
Right. Right. I mean, it's crazy. Guys, John, his first two credits that at least are listed where I can find things are Flags of Our Fathers with Clint Eastwood and ER, which at the time is like the biggest show in television. How does ER come about?
Well, they would film exterior shots sometimes in Chicago.
Oh, got it.
I mean, that was a big one, obviously shooting in Los Angeles, but every now and then they would have the stars of the show kind of outside on the street in Chicago to sort of place it in Chicago. And so I played a doctor. It was like literally Dr. Collins, and the props guy had Dr. Tom Collins, which was kind of a little joke. But yeah, that was opposite Linda Cardellini at the time, which was really, really cool. She's gone on to do so much amazing stuff, particularly like Dead to Me, which I don't know if you've watched that show, which is so great in that show.
Yes. But you're going back to the theater. You're continuing to work in the theater through the aughts that they call them.
And it was always, there were only a handful of theater companies in Chicago at that time that were supportive of theater actors winning on camera work.
Okay.
Without getting, this is going to be really boring, but the contracts in Chicago theater allow for you to go and do on camera work, but it's always up to the theater's discretion. So, you know, as a Midwestern working actor, you don't want to burn bridges, but I was always kind of able to sneak around and do a couple days here, a couple days there.
You're working in the theater. you're getting days or a week or whatever in film and television and also doing voiceover work at this point. How many commercials are you getting around this time?
Well, I actually won campaigns. So I was the voice of Comcast actually for about 3 years for their television commercials. I was doing the VO for them. I was the voice of OnStar for many years. I did several years of McDonald's across many different ad agencies. And throughout that time, I was also picking up different spots for other people who were advertising too. I did a few video games here and there, and I was getting to do on-camera commercials here more and more the later it got. I did a FedEx spot with an on-camera commercial director named Jim Jenkins, and we ended up doing a couple FedEx spots. We did some other like Hyundai spots, and then we did a one-off commercial for Bud Light that ended up kind of becoming this whole Dilly Dilly campaign.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously where I'm going. Of commercials, maybe in history, it rings rings high on the top of people's, whether you loved it or hated it, everybody knew the king in Dilly Dilly. Now, when you're doing this, are you on set, right? So it's like if you're shooting a television show, sometimes you'll be like, wow, you know, this is pretty good. Are you thinking that this is going to change the world, Dilly Dilly?
You know, we did the first one, and we were just, I think Bud Light were doing like four or five. They had a zombie one. They had like a Revolutionary War era one. They had this weird Game of Thrones one, was ours. And then people just started using the phrase Dilly Dilly. And then they brought us back for one around Thanksgiving. And then like late November, they called and they were like, all right, we want to do a Super Bowl spot and we're going to do it it's either going to be South Africa or New Zealand. So get ready. And I was like, excuse me, what? And then we went to New Zealand and we filmed the Super Bowl spots in friggin' New Zealand. And then we filmed in Argentina. We filmed in Czech Republic. We filmed many times in Spain. It was like a real dream to get to work on. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, I think about it in terms of like we were doing beer commercials, but really we were just making ludicrous funny for the benefit of a beer company. It was just a lot of fun being like the stupidest guy in the room who kind of thought he was the smartest guy in the room. Like that's fun. That's fun space to play in.
Well, it's so interesting that you talked very early on about your humorous interp days and choosing to do Monty Python, because really I feel like that's what that commercial was. It was like classic Monty Python humor done in a really big and broad way, but in a way that everyone could understand and ludicrous, but fun, just funny. That's how I viewed it anyway.
Good.
Do you feel like the success of that campaign propelled your career forward?
You know, I was sitting on a boat in Colombia on the Magdalena River with John Krasinski, bitching and moaning about my fear that that campaign would ruin my career. And Krasinski was like, dude, just bet on yourself. And he was also like, everyone's doing commercials these days, man. And I remember like he did, I think his story about Esurance, you probably remember when he did Esurance. For like 15 years after that, all the VO casting departments were like, give us a John Krasinski read. you know, it was funny because I think it was this dumb kind of quasi period character and this big long flowing robe, but it was a character. And I guess the viewing public who were seeing those, either they put it together or they didn't, but if they did, one didn't detract from the other necessarily in an odd way, which I'm very, very grateful for because, you know, as you've been talking about, a lot of the roles that I've played on film and television have been pretty serious. And so I'm grateful. I feel fortunate to have gotten to be a part of those stories, but I also feel grateful and fortunate to get to make funny. You know, if your career starts to go in one direction, people start to think, well, that's what Brian does. That's all Brian wants to do.
Right.
It's not necessarily the case. It's not right. necessarily all Brian can bring to the table. That's just kind of what you guys keep asking Brian to do. That's what it, I think that's what it's been for me. So I feel like I've gotten a few lucky ones in there where I've gotten to do funny stuff too.
That's awesome. Who's John Krasinski?
He was this young actor who he portrayed a fledgling Amazon production.
Yes, John worked with my old pal, other John. John and I just put that together. What was it like working with John on the first two seasons of Jack Ryan?
Oh, he was great, man.
Come on. Just we're looking for truth here. What was it like? What was it like working with John?
This one scene where we were like going into this like suspected terrorist's den in Paris, and John and I were like at the back of a line of like, you know, like hardcore commando type dudes going up the stairs and stuff. And he kept dropping the clip out of his gun on the hard tile floor just to make me laugh. I mean, we were like a couple of fucking children. And it was like, this is a big budget TV show. And every time he did it, I laughed. And then he would just do it again because
he would do it again. Yeah, that sounds about right.
I will say this is a cool thing. So between season one and season two, A Quiet Place came out.
Yes.
And it changed the dynamic on set going into season two. And John had suddenly a lot more ability to kind of talk about how he saw the scenes coming together. And it was really cool to see him kind of rise to the moment.
Hmm.
This is a thing that is like, you know, I think there are actors out there who just love to play different roles. And then there are actors who are geared to kind of take over the world. And John is one of the second category. I mean, he's like the people that you see at the top of their game. It's not a mistake. They put in a lot of time, a lot of effort, worked really freaking hard. And that was kind of my take on John. But John is awesome. He's been really cool. I wish I could give you more shitty stories. But he always like he was one of these dudes who was so we're surrounded by Navy SEALs, which is kind of like. You don't want to do your own stunts. That's cool. You know, but John always wanted to do his own stunts because he didn't want to catch any shade from these Navy SEALs.
oh, he did. Come on. He didn't do them all. Come on.
Man, it's like, and some of them were kind of dangerous. Like we've all been like kind of busted up on that set, but he just keeps coming back. He's a tank, man. He's getting it done.
Wow.
I can see I've let you down.
I mean, a little bit. He and I relates to Jack Ryan. This is like such a humble brag story, but I was invited to Europe basically to play golf with Prince Albert of Monaco. And I am in this very, very fancy, nice hotel. And there was a yacht thing. I mean, it was the whole thing. And my phone goes off. It's in the evening. My phone goes off and it's a text message from John. I don't remember exactly what it was, but my memory is that the text message says, "What the fuck? Are you in Monaco?" And I was like, first of all, how do you know? Like, what, where? I'm like looking around and he was there. I don't know if you were there. He was there, I think, to like do some festival or I don't know, but it was about Jack Ryan. It was like the opening of Jack Ryan or whatever. And he was there. And so there you go. We can't see each other in the United States, but you know, suddenly we're like sleeping next to each other in this hotel in Monaco. You guys went Montreal, Colombia, Morocco, France. How was that? How was it? I mean, it sounds like you did that for the Dilly Dilly too. How was that traveling around so much on that show? Was it fun or was it a grind?
It was fun. It was an incredible experience, particularly like our time in Morocco. One of the coolest things I did was I, I got to go out to the Western Sahara and spend the night in the desert on the dunes. And that was absolutely an amazing experience. Yeah. And the time in Colombia was, we were on like the National Police Training Headquarters near a small city called Girardot in kind of central Colombia, about 2.5 hours away from Bogota. Yeah, man, it was super intense and very challenging, but ultimately a really, really cool ride.
You've said that the role reminded you of your own inner voice or your family back home. What do you mean by that?
I'm just kind of talking about like dudes you'd come across in North Carolina who were just kind of like, man, I'm going to tell you what, earlier this week, our dog was in the yard and a turkey walked across the yard and the dog ran after and that turkey ended up in a tree. I mean, just that kind of stuff.
Okay.
It just is kind of like, that's what's below all the theater school training, you know?
Right.
So when I went in to read for that, I just kind of let it roll. And I saw this guy as someone who is actually, if you play badass, it kind of makes him seem like maybe he's not such a badass.
Right.
I just kind of thought that he, placing him in a sort of real approachable place made him more of a real human being. And I guess that's all I was going for.
The journey to a smoke-free future can be a long and winding road. But if you're ready for a change, consider taking Zyn for a spin. Zyn nicotine pouches offer a fresh way to discover your nicotine satisfaction. Anywhere, anytime. No smoke, no spit, and no lingering odor. Ready to start your new journey? Get in gear with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Enjoy Zyn nicotine pouches for 10 days and discover a fresher way to experience nicotine satisfaction anywhere, anytime. Here's how to get started with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Simply pick your strength and varieties online and check out. Once your Zyn nicotine pouches arrive in the mail, enjoy pure nicotine satisfaction at your leisure. After your 10-day trial, let us know what you think. If Zyn isn't for you, no hard feelings. It's that simple. Order online at Zyn.com, that's ZYN.com, to start your new journey today with the Zyn 10 Challenge. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I have to mention a show, and I don't know that I ever do this when I'm talking to people, talk specifically about my feelings, unless it's just straight praise of a show. You had a role of Carl Wilkes in Castle Rock. I thought that show was so freaking interesting. I thought it was flawed. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought a lot of it didn't work. It's so complicated that it's hard to even explain what it is, except it's basically Stephen King's mind and his characters throughout the history of his writings existing semi-simultaneously in the same town. John plays Annie Wilkes' father. Annie Wilkes, of course, going on to be the villain, the lead of Misery, played by Kathy Bates, who appeared in The Office. Boom. There's my association. F. John Krasinski. F. John Krasinski. You played the father of Annie Wilkes that Kathy Bates won an Oscar for. Talk to me about the experience that you had on that show. Was Stephen King around?
I'm sure he was in touch with the producers and the writers and everyone. He was not generally.
He was not. Okay, good. Okay. That makes me feel better that I wasn't involved.
We were in Massachusetts. That filmed in Massachusetts, which was beautiful when we were there. We were about an hour west of Boston. And Lizzie Kaplan, who played Annie, and Ruby Cruz, who played young Annie in the flashbacks, both just phenomenal talents. Lizzie, man, she was just so committed, so professional. It was a super intense experience, particularly, I guess, is it a spoiler if I talk about kind of the final scene?
I mean, I didn't know. No, it's been 4 years. No, it's not a spoiler. Go ahead.
The dad is pushed down some stairs.
A flight of stairs. You did that stunt yourself, like John, right?
Yes, myself, yes. And I was impaled on a banister, and they run a hose of blood kind of up your shirt and next to your face. And that's kind of going off while you play this scene with your daughter. And it was super intense, but actually a lot of fun and really, really disturbing.
Really disturbing. But,
it's a lot of fun to get to do horror every now and then, to scare people and to dig into the things that people are, I was going to say triggered by, but that's kind of a loaded term.
Yeah. I just thought that the series was super fascinating, and it's good to hear that it was a good experience, and also not surprising that it was difficult. An amazing cast. And yeah, if you haven't checked it out, it's worth checking out. Gotta talk to you about Dope Sick, the show of 2021, 2022 for sure. Randy Ramsire. Yeah. Whatever. Randy. this is my reference to the playing a cop in Western North Carolina, close but not quite. Talk to me about your experience working on Dope Sick. And interestingly, an incredibly dark, I loved it, incredibly dark show. Did you have a positive experience working on Dope Sick? And did you expect that to be, well, the show of the last year or so?
I absolutely had a positive experience on it. I learned so much. You know, that's one of the conversations that has been on a slow boil in this country for over 20 years.
Too slow.
Reading OxyContin and all these things going on. We've all known that we've been kind of fed a line on these prescription painkillers, but it wasn't until shows and documentarians really started to do a kind of a deep dive into the connection between this one company and the way that these drugs are sort of insinuated into the healing process when you get hospitalized, and kind of making all these connections and finding out that certain aspects of the testing going through the FDA were all kind of fiddled with. It woke me up to a lot of ways that we can certainly do better. Danny Strong, who was the writer and the producer, was a constant. It was like walking around with an encyclopedia. This guy had so much knowledge in his brain the whole time. But also, it was kind of like that situation where the darker the subject matter, the more levity there is off screen. because the people telling those stories have to find a balance or you will just absolutely go insane.
Yes.
You know, it's a very different path for an actor on a set like that. And the cool thing is casts and the producers sort of understand what it is that you have to find within yourself on a given day, and they will give you space to find it, and they will kind of try and find a way to be supportive of you. But it was we shot that in and around Richmond, Virginia. It was a lovely town to get to work in. It was a great experience. And the first couple episodes were directed, of course, by Barry Levinson, which was a real honor to get to work with him. He's one of these directors who knows exactly what's going in the final cut. He knows what he's going to use. So he's very efficient and very direct in getting what he needed from the actors. It was wonderful to get to work with all those guys.
Being from North Carolina, now living back in North Carolina, that is a state and an area there that has suffered a lot from the opioid epidemic. Did you have a personal connection to this because of that?
Yeah, there are Suboxone clinics, which is one of the drugs that they try and do replacement therapy with all over the place here. And I think that was one of the things that I learned, is that cold turkey and prayer doesn't work all that well, unfortunately, with people who are addicted to drugs like this. You're lucky if you get off it and stay off it at all. A lot of times the more humane way to stop using it is to slowly step down with a replacement. And there certainly it has touched, these addictions have touched people in my family. They've touched so many people in America, and it's something that's like a dirty little household secret for so many people. And that was one of the things that I was eager to tackle, was how are we going to portray people who become addicted to this drug? You know, if it's a high school football player who suffers a knee injury and is given OxyContin, and then 4 months later, their life is ruined and they have to find something cheaper, so they switch to heroin. Generally, we in this country, I think, have thought of people who become drug addicts as morally weak, or people who have suffered.
That's right.
And the reality is often so much more nuanced than that. And so I think one of the things that the show really got right was how you can become addicted to some of these drugs when the situation is constructed and architected in such a way to make people become addicted through no fault of your own. And I feel like that was a thing that the show got right, because that was one of the comments that we got over and over and over again was, oh man, my aunt suffered this, my grandmother, my son, my daughter, I'm still working on this, you know? And then I have had people, friends and family, who have, you know, kind of casually over the years asked about, yeah, if you have any pills, or because I'm suffering this and I'm having a hard time getting blah, blah, blah. That's what that is.
That's right.
And I know, you know, the other argument is, when shows go after OxyContin like this, you're taking a very valuable tool out of the doctor's hands. And I don't think that was what the show was saying. I think what the show was saying was, like, when you're dealing with end of life pain, or when you are under a doctor's direct supervision, this is an absolutely a valuable tool, but it's not a valuable tool for myriad other injuries that one can sustain and live with, and perhaps manage with different classes of drugs that are not addictive in the same way that an opioid is.
Yeah, that was certainly my takeaway. That really the issue was the lack of transparency with how addictive it was, and then potentially the over-prescribing, which triggered that faster and faster.
Walking into a hospital, you know, with an injury or some severe pain, and being shown, you know, the smiley face graph from smiley to frowny, where are you on this spectrum? And learning that was kind of something that was constructed to make pain treatment a conversation that's at the front and center of conversations with doctors when you're healing. And obviously dealing with pain is horrible and something that needs to be done empathetically. But when you have a company that stands to gain billions of dollars kind of wagging the federal government around or its agencies, that's something that we need to look very, very closely at to make sure that, you know, ideally, the government exists to make sure that we are kept safe from the crueler intentions of corporate entities.
Did you meet Randy?
I did meet Randy. Yeah. He and I got to Zoom, and then he came to an event, I think, in Washington, got to meet him there, and he was a super laid back, cool guy. And these guys were like bulldogs. Like, they were immovable. They weren't going anywhere once they started with this. And that's kind of the cool thing. It's like, you may think of us as small town, and therefore you may not take us seriously, but we take this job very seriously. We work on the taxpayer's dime, and we're not going to stop until justice has been served. Yeah, really compelling story, him and Rick Mountcastle.
Just out. Not that you need any more buzz, John, but Waco, The Aftermath. I'm very, very interested in this. When I went to SMU, this is when the Waco happened. From the public television in my dorm room in college, we watched it. And of course, it's, I don't know, 60, 80 miles down the road, this was all taking place. So I feel this weird connection to it. I don't want you to give any spoilers, but what was that like going back to yet another true story, a tragedy, and exploring the aftermath of that?
So Clive Doyle, who I portray in the show, was a Branch Davidian. I remember that time too. I was 15, turning 16 that April.
Yeah.
I remember, probably like you do, there were, it was like three or four network news sources that were all kind of giving the same information on the standoff. And the idea was basically these people were insane and they were making the situation worse and worse. And the government was just trying to get the kids out of there and keep everybody safe. And I think that's all generally accurate. However, there's so much more that went into pushing the government into the standoff and that kept this group of ultra-Orthodox in the middle of the desert in Texas from complying and coming out of the buildings. Without giving anything away, Clive immigrated to the United States in the early 60s with his mom from Australia and had been at the compound for 30 years already when the fire happened. So I thought at the time that this was kind of a new group of people, and
right,
they moved, and this is, they were into guns and they were marrying girls off very young. And this community had been there for many decades, even prior to Clive arriving in the 60s. From a technical aspect, they wanted an actor who could find a way to also weave in a Texas dialect to this sort of soft Australian accent. So that was kind of a fun challenge to try and tackle. But Clive was, I think, tantamount to a monk. He also inhabited a world where miracles were all over the place. And this guy sitting next to him, who begins as Vernon Howell and then kind of chooses the name David Koresh, is to this group of people, he's the embodiment of God. He literally is the Lamb, they believe. And at a certain point, Koresh tells this group of people, I'm the only one who can have sex with anyone. So if you're married and I choose your wife, you have to be okay with that. And stunning how many of them stayed. So to kind of study this against the backdrop of everything the federal government was doing at the time, it's an incredibly messy story from so many angles.
Yeah.
I think that the takeaway for the federal government was, if you back people with extreme beliefs into a corner, it's likely that they will do extreme things. Technically, what that means is that the government ends up acting more empathetically when there are guns involved, then that's a good thing. As an actor, I want more empathy everywhere. I want us to strive to understand the worldview of those that we don't agree with. We have to make the effort to understand, which is distinct and separate from agreeing with them.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know that we're all going to ever agree on everything. I don't think that's realistic. But we have to spend time trying to understand. And that's why I think this show is important, is it's a continued meditation on what went wrong, which means producers and a network are sitting around trying to understand how we got to that place then. And the Dowdles, the producers and directors and creators of the show, are drawing a bright red line from that event to Charlottesville and to January 6th.
I think, one, you're awesome. Two, the point that you bring up there is so important on both sides of this debate or war that's raging in the United States, and not having any empathy for the other side, whatever side that is, and behaving toward them in a harsh and unsympathetic and unempathetic way is only going to make them strengthen their resolve, as you said. That's incredible. Because, yeah, we're still trying to figure it out. God, and side note, I don't even know. I mean, I watched this other show. Did they talk about that in the Waco that had been going on that long? In the 60s it had been going on? I missed that. I had no idea.
Yeah, Lois Roden, J. Smith Cameron, wonderful actor, who plays Lois Roden in this season. Yeah. She is the prophet of the era. And she sort of inherited being the prophet from her husband, who inherited it from another guy. So it's a shoot-off of a shoot-off of the Seventh-day Adventist denomination.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the kind of thing where, and again, I want to talk about it without demeaning a group of people's beliefs. So it would be, you know, the idea that it's all going to end on this day. And then that day comes and goes. And then I've gotten another prophecy and now I was wrong. It's actually going to end on this day and so forth and so on. And the Branch Davidians, it was known by the federal government at this point that their theology was that the world was going to end in fire. And they had listening devices in the compound and apparently had audio of the Branch Davidians planning to set fire in various locations if the federal government ever breached the walls. They knew that, the tear gas they were going to use was highly flammable. And they also knew that the Branch Davidians had been talking about setting fire. So it does become very, very messy. So two things that I think about on this show are like David Koresh committed suicide by cop and he took 80 souls with him. And the federal government, for its part, was overeager to be used in that regard for a number of reasons. Also, there were three government entities on the ground at Waco. You had the ATF, which started the raid and called cameras there to film it because they were facing an existential crisis in Congress and they needed a televised win. So this standoff ultimately becomes a debacle and a tragedy. But when four ATF agents are killed and the FBI shows up, now you have two forces who are not actually working in concert. And then you have the hostage rescue team who has its own goals. So there was no general sort of telling everybody what the next step needs to be.
Yeah.
And tragedy ensues.
Fascinating. Yeah,
it's something that we spent a lot of time learning about and studying about. And I don't mean to say the federal government is 100% to blame or that the Branch Davidians are 100% to blame, but it is worthy of study.
Well, that's, you know, where great art lives, as far as I'm concerned, is in the question, not in the answers. So exploring all sides is valuable and ultimately, hopefully, changes things for the future. John, thank you so much for your time. Knox Goes Away. I hear you've just wrapped principal photography on that. Another Michael Keaton adventure. Good luck with that. I'm a big fan of his and a huge fan of yours as well. I will be watching whatever you do next.
Thank you for this time together. This has been a lot of fun, man.
Yeah. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Thank you.
John, that was so much fun. Thank you so much for hopping on. After talking to you, let me just say, I am so excited to watch Waco, The Aftermath. It was a story I followed very closely years ago, but to hear the resonances from today's world, well, I just can't wait. Listeners, make sure to look out for John in Waco. He is going to be awesome. I know it. And of course, make sure to leave a comment on our Instagram. Tune into next week for Off the Beat. Same time, same place, same me. We'll see you then. Off the Beat is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Diego Tapia. Our producers are Liz Hayes, Hannah Harris, and Emily Carr. Our talent producer is Ryan Papa Zachary, and our intern is Sammy Katz. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by the one and only Creed Bratton.
If you're a smoker or dipper looking to make a change, you really only need one reason to do it. But with Zyn nicotine pouches, you can find many. Zyn is America's number one nicotine pouch. It's made with only 6 simple ingredients. Plus, Zyn is the only nicotine pouch with a 10-day hassle-free trial. There are lots of options when it comes to nicotine satisfaction, but there's only one Zyn. Find your Zyn online or in a store near you at zyn.com/find. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.